Good morning, church. Today's reading is Matthew 1:1 and 17. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated.
There is a cultural phenomenon that is gaining momentum in the last couple decades that is really interesting. People are really super fascinated by pursuing their genealogy, determining their family tree. Well, that's been around forever, but it seems like in the last few decades, I would guess, that it's become much more popular. Here's some examples. The website Ancestry.com, place you can go and they'll help you find your heritage, 37 million visits a month. There have been, at this point, a dozen different television shows produced just about people finding their genealogy, usually celebrities, but sometimes it's people like you and I. And then also I've noticed that in recent years, it has become a standard assignment in school. Our two kids are in their 20s, but when they were in elementary school, they had to do a project in which they had to trace their family back a few generations. I happen to have our son Luke's project with us. Yeah, look at him, not bad for like a fifth grader. I'm sure his mom did most of it. And of course, Luke's a creative type, so he didn't do a tree. He took his four grandparents and made them circles and spread out. But for those of you who have been to school recently or you have kids in school, is this pretty common to do a family tree of some type? For those of us who have been, school was a long time ago for us. Maybe you didn't have to do it then, but nowadays this is kind of the thing that we're doing. And they didn't have trees. I thought you were going to say they didn't have schools, but anyway. This is something that a lot of people are fascinated by now. And in doing this with both of our kids, we learned a lot of great information about our family. There are some observations that we can make about this interest now in people's genealogies. Can we all agree that all of us secretly hope that our family tree contains someone famous? And as soon as you find out someone is famous in your family tree, you tell everyone. For example, my wife, Melissa, her family, they can trace themselves all the way back to William Bradford, who, it's been a while since you've had history class, he was one of the governors of the Plymouth Colony. He helped put together the Mayflower Compact, and he was integral in the beginning stages of what eventually became United States of America. That's pretty impressive, right? Yeah, that's kind of why I married her. I mean, that's a pretty good tidbit to have to share at parties and things. So we all secretly hope that we have someone in our family tree who's famous. We all know that we have someone in our family tree who's straight up crazy. We all have that uncle, or that second cousin, or the person sitting next to you right now, who is just, you wonder what branch they grew from, and how did that happen? And if you're having a hard time thinking of someone crazy in your family, I hate to break it to you, you're the crazy one in your family, and there's nothing you can do about it. So we all hope someone's famous, we all know someone's crazy, but we all have really interesting stories. On Wednesday mornings here at church, the staff gets together, and whoever's teaching that next weekend shares a little of the message, and then we have some time in prayer and do some business things, and it's a great time of community for our staff. And when I shared this is what we were doing this morning, everyone around the table began to share interesting stories about their history, where they came from. Here's mine. My father's father, my grandfather on my dad's side, unfortunately, both of his parents died very early in his life. He was not even a year old, and both his mom and his dad had passed away, my great-grandparents. And so my grandfather was adopted by his maternal grandparents and took on their last name, which is Young. And now, several generations later, that's why I am Mark Young. If that had not happened, or if my grandfather had kept his given last name and not adopted name, you would be looking today at Mark Schickedons. Now, I don't wish that my great-grandparents had passed away early in my grandfather's life, but I think I dodged a bullet here. I really did. I mean, it'd be tough being picked on for that last name, not knowing how to spell it till like fourth grade. It's rough. So young, we're pretty happy with that, pretty basic. But I think if we were to take the time, each of you probably has interesting stories from your genealogy as well. We're fascinated by them, right? Like, we're interested. Where did we come from? What were the historical twists and turns that got you to be here today? Genealogies are fascinating, and it's interesting to hear where people came from. Well, genealogies are actually quite important in the biblical narrative as well, but we don't find them quite as interesting, let's just be honest. Genealogies are a very important but often overlooked part of the biblical account. And it's for logical reasons. They're mostly in the Old Testament, although we're going to look at one this morning. They're very long. They contain very weird names. Young couples are not running to the genealogies in the Bible to find baby names. For example, I know of no kids named Abinadab or Jehoshaphat. Although Jehoshaphat Shikadons, that kid's going places. I'd like to meet him. So there's weird names, and they're really long. In fact, can we really be honest for a moment? Maybe you're starting a Bible reading plan like a lot of people are. Our Anomaly kids, a bunch of them are doing a Bible reading plan this year. When you come to a genealogy in the Old Testament, you think to yourself, sweet, I can skip through this in about 5 seconds. Lots of names, I don't know any of them, on to the next chapter. That's kind of how we think about genealogies in the Bible. And yet, they're extremely important, and it's somewhat surprising that one of the four authors of the Gospels, Matthew, the first one that we find in our New Testament, Matthew begins his Gospel with a genealogy. And we set it up this way. If you have your notes, if you grab them on your way in this morning, or if you want to go onto YouTube and then go under events and find our church, you can look at the notes there as well. We thought we would kick off this idea and get our minds moving in the right direction with, I think, some pretty honest questions here. So the Apostle Matthew, as we're going to see this morning, he starts his gospel account of the life and ministry of Jesus, and he doesn't start it with a jaw-dropping miracle. Like, that would get our attention right away. Or some really provocative teaching. No, he starts his gospel with a genealogy. And as we're going to see this morning and throughout this series, this Matthew series, that will probably take us till about 2032, at the rate we go and as big as this book is, Matthew is the third largest book in the New Testament, Matthew's going to really focus on Jesus being king. And so it begs the question, why introduce the king with a boring list of hard-to-pronounce names? Should it be more like in the movie Aladdin, when Ali comes in and the genie's fit, and it's all the fanfare and the Prince Ali, like that, right? That's how you introduce a king. You don't introduce a king with a list of names, many of which we don't know who they are. And so we're going to try to tackle that this morning and see if we can figure that out. But before we jump into the text and look at this list and get some insight from it, we want to take a step back since we're starting this brand new series in the Gospel of Matthew, which we're really excited about, and take a look at the whole book from about 30,000 feet. And this is actually a really good exercise for each of us to enter whenever you're about to study a book in the Bible. It's important that we know from a large macro level what's happening here before we dive into the minutiae of various verses and chapters and things. In fact, for many people, they will make the mistake of pulling a verse out of a context and can often make it say something that it's not meant to say. And so we want to be very careful that context matters and culture matters, and if we take a larger view of the book when we get into it, will recognize the themes and the ideas that the author is presenting. I'm always a little nervous by what I call magnet verses. Those are verses that you put on your magnet on your refrigerator, or bumper sticker verses, because at times when they're pulled out of context, they end up meaning something different, and we don't want to do that here at Desert Breeze, so we want to take the time, just for a few minutes, and think about Matthew in a larger scale, and then we'll jump in and start looking at the actual text itself. And so a tool that I have used for years now. I used it quite a bit when I taught Bible at Northwest Christian School, and I've used it in my own personal life, and it's really been helpful for me whenever I start a new book, is I start with this question. What is, in this case, Matthew? What is Matthew all about? And about is an acronym that gives you five things that are really good to know before you start reading a book of the Bible. It's great to know who the author is and where he has come from, the background behind the writing of the letter. An outline is always helpful, kind of gives us a guidepost of where we're going. The uniqueness, which for me is the question, if this book was missing from the Bible, what would we be missing? What makes this book so special that it's part of our Bible? And then finally, a theme. So first, the author. Matthew was written by Matthew. Matthew was a disciple, an apostle of Jesus, but he was also a tax collector. And if you're familiar with the way Rome ran their empire during the time of Jesus, they were pretty ingenious about how they would exercise taxes away from the communities that they had conquered. Because they had such a large infrastructure of territory and land and people, the Roman government would come into a new territory, break it up into grids, and then they would let local individuals bid on the right to be the tax collector in that area. They were often called publicans or public revenue collectors. We often call them tax collectors. And so you would bid on this territory, and then you got to take care of all the taxes in that area with Roman guards protecting you. And the Roman government would say, we need you to collect this much money. Anything above that is yours to keep. And so tax collectors, as you can well imagine, the IRS of Israel at this time, would tax way over the top. And that's how they became rich. They were considered traitors in their area, bottom feeders of society. We see in the Gospels that oftentimes tax collectors were thought of as being lower than Gentiles and prostitutes. They were at the bottom of the barrel because they worked for Rome and took money from their own people. And this is Matthew before he meets Jesus. And we'll see in a few chapters in Matthew chapter 9 that Jesus walks up to Matthew one day and asks Matthew to follow him. And Matthew leaves tax collecting and becomes a follower of Jesus. And if you've watched the television show The Chosen at all, they have done a really great job of depicting that tension when a tax collector is in a group of other Jewish men. You've noticed that in The Chosen, Matthew was not well received at first. Peter especially had issue with him. And that was very close to what was probably the reality of a tax collector. They were completely shunned by their culture. And one of those individuals is a follower of Jesus and writes one of the Gospels. It's pretty great. The background. As you may or may not know, after Jesus' crucifixion, resurrection, and then 40 days later, his ascension, those early followers, disciples and apostles of Jesus, pretty much just spread throughout the world, orally sharing their eyewitness testimonies of Jesus. Nothing was really written down for about the 30 or 40 years after Jesus had ascended. And then these early disciples recognized maybe Jesus isn't coming back as quickly as we thought he was. And there are new generations of people following Jesus who never got to witness him. And so they begin to write things down. And Matthew specifically writes down his recollection of the life of Jesus, the ministry of Jesus, the teachings and the miracles of Jesus. And Matthew writes specifically to a Jewish audience, his own people. And that's why his goal is that he wants to show that Jesus is the continuation and fulfillment of the whole biblical story. He is the Messiah that's been promised in the Old Testament. And so you're going to watch as we walk through Matthew that Matthew is very intentional about focusing on who Jesus is in connection to the Old Testament, why he proves to be king. And as a reader, original reader of this book, you would be, as a Jewish individual, very aware, keenly aware of the connections Matthew is making of Jesus to the Old Testament. And we'll look at these as we come across them. Each gospel author has a specific audience in mind. Matthew's is the Jewish audience proving that Jesus is king. Okay, quick little outline for you, because I know outlines are super exciting for most people. No, they are not. They're very boring, but some of us like them. The great thing about Matthew's book and the way it's organized is I want you to think about it as a section at the top, a section at the bottom, and then five sections in between. Matthew begins, as we'll see today, with a genealogy and then the birth and early life of Jesus. He ends with the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. And those two big stories, those narratives, bookend the entire book. Then Matthew takes and includes five large movements or five large sections within the middle of the book, each one its own independent set of teachings and miracles, teachings and miracles, teachings and miracles, teachings and miracles. And Matthew's intentional with this, and a lot of biblical scholars believe that he did this because he wanted those five sections to mirror the five early books of the Old Testament, what we call the Law or the Pentateuch. Again, a Jewish connection, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Law, and his five movements of teaching and miracles mirror the five books of the Old Testament at the beginning. Now, I like to arrange the outline this way because now, to me, it looks like a meatball sub. And so the birth and the crucifixion resurrection are the meat, and the five teaching sections are your meatballs right in the middle of it. So once again, like most of my teachings, this one is also brought to you by EG's. Find yourself time to go get a meatball sub this afternoon. So yeah, Matthew, meatball sub. There you go. There's the outline. Okay, uniqueness. What makes Matthew so special is that he refers to and quotes from the Old Testament more than any other New Testament book. 100 different references to the Old Testament in Matthew's gospel. That's like three or four a chapter. 53 times, he uniquely quotes the Old Testament. In fact, we're going to see as we move through the letter that Matthew will make a statement about Jesus, or he'll take a saying of Jesus, and then Matthew will comment on the side, this is in fulfillment of, and quote some Old Testament prophet or something from the Law. He is very astute about letting us know that every time Jesus does something, it connects back to the Old Testament. Everything about the Old Testament points to Jesus. The theme that we've chosen for this letter is that Jesus is a king like no other. And you're going to notice pretty quickly that he really leans into the idea of Jesus as king. There are 10 different times that Matthew refers to Jesus as the son of David, which in Jewish mindset would be that lets you know this is the king that's been promised, the king we've been waiting for, the one that David was promised back in 2 Samuel. There are 16 times that Matthew refers to Jesus as Christ. That's a Greek term. 10 times he refers to him as Messiah. That's a Hebrew and Aramaic term. They both essentially mean the same thing. Messiah and Christ describe someone who is anointed, the anointed one, or king. So anytime you see Christ, don't think that's Jesus' last name, because it's not. He didn't grow up with Joseph and Mary Christ, and the mailbox outside their home was the Christ. No, Christ is a title for Jesus, much like Messiah, and they point to him as being king. 54 times, Matthew talks about the kingdom. And 32 times, he actually calls it the kingdom of heaven, which is pretty rare because that phrase only shows up 34 times in the whole New Testament. 32 of them are in Matthew. What is the kingdom of heaven? We're going to explore that a lot in this series. How are we, as followers of Jesus, part of the kingdom of heaven? And so that's the about of Matthew. We'll keep these things in mind as we go through the letter together, but it's really helpful to think about Jesus as king throughout all of these passages because that is Matthew's main goal, to show that he is the king. So let's jump into the text. If you have your Bibles and you're not there yet, why don't you go to Matthew chapter 1. Rhiannon did a great job of reading for us the first verse of our section for today and the last verse, because Rhiannon's a friend of mine and I'm not going to make her read all of those names. In fact, I'm not going to do it either. We're going to look at them and nod in approval, but they're there. You can spend some time this afternoon. You can go on ChatGPT and find out, how do I say this name right here? But the important part is how Matthew begins and ends his genealogy. Then we'll look at the genealogy itself. For Matthew, his plan from the get-go is to show that Jesus fulfills the Old Testament storyline. And he does that within the first verse. Look at verse 1 with me again, where he says this: the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, King Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Jump down to verse 17. At the end of the list of names, Matthew summarizes and says, so all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations. That's a significant time period in Israel's history. From the patriarch Abraham to the most famous and powerful king of Israel, David. Matthew says that section of time, 14 generations. From David, the monarchy, through the United Kingdom and then to the divided kingdom, to the end of the kingdom time in Israel, from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And then once that deportation happens and Israel is in exile, through the time when they return home eventually after 70 years, up until the time of Jesus, 14 generations. So a couple of insights from the actual genealogy itself. First of all, Matthew intentionally traces Jesus' genealogy through three very important individuals, two of them super important to the nation of Israel's history. And the third one, he connects him to his father. He connects, first of all, Jesus to Abraham, and this is to show that Jesus will be a blessing to all humanity. When God made his covenant with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, he promised Abraham a few things if Abraham, by faith, would follow God. He promised Abraham a land that would be his and his people's. He promised him a great nation. And he also promised Abraham that Abraham would be a blessing to all the nations someday. When Matthew connects Jesus all the way back to Abraham, he is hinting to his audience, this Jesus is the one who will fulfill that promise from Abraham. Jesus will be the one who is a blessing to all the nations. Jesus is God's rescue plan for the nations. Matthew also connects Jesus to David. And of course, this is, in a Jewish mindset, the king. And so Israel's Messiah, David, leads to Jesus. David is promised in 2 Samuel 7 that his kingdom would reign forever. And every king after David came and went. Jesus, if he's going to be the forever king, must be somehow connected to David. So for Jesus to be able to trace his genealogy back to Abraham and David is significant. And Matthew points that out in this genealogy. But he also connects Jesus to Joseph, who is his legal lineage. We are hopefully well aware of the fact that Joseph was not Jesus' biological father. But in the nation of Israel, it was far more important who your legal father was than who your biological father was. Because your legal father was the one who dictated where your lineage came from. At the time of Jesus, if you wanted to own land in the nation of Israel, you had to document your father's lineage back 8 generations. That's how critical it is for you to know where you came from. Who is your father? Who is your father's father? You'll see this a lot in the Old Testament, where individuals are described by their name and then who their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers are. And so for Jesus to be connected to Joseph, and it's actually Joseph's line that is traced back to David and then to Abraham, verifies that Jesus legally is of this lineage, even though biologically he's not. The other thing that's great, and Matthew points it out to us again in that last verse we read, verse 17, the second thing that I think is fascinating is that Matthew intentionally arranges Jesus' genealogy into three groups of 14 generations. And that 14 number is significant if you are one from the nation of Israel. Because the number 14 over the years had developed to be the numerical equivalent to the name David. 14 became the number that was associated with David, and I'll show you why in just a moment. But again, even the way that Matthew organizes the genealogy and sections them into three groupings from the three major time periods in Israel's history, but make sure that there are 14 names in each of those sections, just screams to the audience, this guy is the promised Messiah from David. Let's throw on the screen the actual chart of the genealogy. So there you go. There are all the names listed from verse 2 through verse 16. And again, if you're new parents or you're going to get married here soon or you're thinking about having children someday, feel free to choose from that list. Maybe Jacob, maybe David. Probably shouldn't choose Jesus. But yeah, Zerubbabel is always a fun name to say and spell as well. Now, here's what's interesting about this genealogy. Like all the genealogies in the Bible, authors were allowed to take some creative liberties in how they organized and orchestrated the names in a genealogy. This is very common because every author of the Bible who includes a genealogy has theological implications behind it. It's not just a list of names. It's a list of names to point us in a certain direction. For example, in the first section there on the left, there is about a 300-year gap between Salmon and Boaz that Matthew just skips right on over. You're like, how can you do that? How can this be legitimate? There is the ability to take genealogies as long as you stick within the family. If you want to manipulate the time periods a little bit to make a point, you're allowed to. In the second middle section, which is all of the kings of Israel and Judah, he skips three or four of the kings in various places. You'll also notice that David is on there twice. He's the end of the first section. He's the beginning of the second section. Why is Matthew doing this? What's his point behind this? Well, as I just mentioned to you, the number 14 really connects the individual to the name David, and here's why. In the original Hebrew language and early iterations of the Hebrew language, there were no vowels. You would just write the consonants. You also wouldn't put any breaks between words and sentences. It's just a string of letters. And from that, we had to figure out what were the words that were being used. So if there were no vowels originally, and you took the name David, which would be a D, a V, and a D in our English language, but in Hebrew there are other things. By the way, David is the first DVD. You can stream him now, but back in the day, he was the first DVD. Well, the letter D in the Hebrew alphabet is connected to the number 4. V is connected to 6, and then another D be connected to 4. You add up David's letters, and you get 14. This is called gematria. It's when letters have numeric values. It's not that uncommon. All of us did this as kids, right? Didn't you make codes when you were a kid? My codes were really hard to crack. A was 1. B was 2, C was 3, and then you'd write notes to your friends, and then you'd pass them, and then they had to crack the code. Let's play baseball after school. You know, really high-tech stuff. How CIA didn't tap into that, I don't know how. But the same thing is here, that letters were connected to numbers, and numbers were connected to letters. And David's name, in the three consonants that make his name, add up to 14. Matthew has formatted the genealogy in such a way that it not only historically points Jesus back to David, but it even graphically and literarily connects us back to David. It's pretty powerful. Okay, one more insight from this list, and that is you'll notice that there are 4 women mentioned by name in Matthew's genealogy. Now, that may not mean much to us, but that was incredibly rare in biblical times. Because again, it was your father and your father's father and so on that was most important. And so for a woman to show up in a genealogy was highly unconventional. Matthew includes 4. Let's take a moment and talk about those 4 ladies that are in that list. Women rarely appear, but Matthew intentionally references 4 women in Jesus' genealogy. First one is Tamar. Tamar's story shows up in Genesis chapter 38. There was Abraham, his son Isaac, his son Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. One of them was Judah. Judah's son, one of his sons, was married to Tamar. That son died, And typically at that time, the custom would be that if a woman finds herself widowed but still of childbearing age, and her husband had died, she would then marry someone else in that family, typically the next oldest brother, so that that family lineage could continue. And when Tamar's husband dies, Judah does not do the wise thing for her and leaves her as a widow, does not allow her to marry any more of her sons. And Tamar decides to take matters into her own hands. And she knows where Judah is out with his crew and his flock. And so she goes to that town, dresses up as a prostitute, veils her face, and gets impregnated by Judah, her father-in-law. That's not the kind of story that you share at the family dinner table on Thanksgiving. Kids, gather around. Let me tell you about your ancestors. And yet from Tamar is born Perez, who is part of the lineage that continues on that eventually gets us to Jesus. He could have just mentioned Perez and moved on, but Matthew intentionally says, oh, by Tamar, you all remember that, don't you? And someone who knows their Old Testament will go, oh yeah, Genesis 38. That is quite the blemish on the nation of Israel's history. Tamar's the first one. Second one, Rahab. Rahab's story, pretty famous, Joshua chapter 2. Israel is about to enter into the promised land, and the first city that they encounter is Jericho. Jericho has these massive walls. And prior to moving into the promised land, they send in 12 spies. And Rahab, a Gentile, much like Tamar was a Gentile, and Rahab is a prostitute, much like Tamar played the role of a prostitute, Rahab hides the spies from the officials of Jericho. And after Jericho is seized and destroyed, Rahab joins in and becomes part of the nation of Israel, marries an Israeli man, and continues on the lineage that eventually gets to David and eventually gets to Jesus. Next, Ruth. Ruth's story is in the book of Ruth, 4 chapters. Ruth is a Moabite. I won't take the time to tell you where the Moabites came from, but it's similar to where Tamar's kids came from. Lot had an encounter with his daughters back in earlier parts of Genesis, and out of that came a young man named Moab. Ruth is a Moabite, essentially an entire people group that came out of an incestuous relationship. And Ruth is married to a man of Israel living in Moab, and that man dies. And Ruth doesn't stay in Moab. She travels with her mother-in-law, Naomi, back to Israel. And so Ruth is living in a foreign land, an outsider, an immigrant, with no husband, living with her mother-in-law. And Boaz comes along and is her kinsman redeemer, marries Boaz, and they are just a couple generations away from King David. Last woman mentioned in the genealogy, and actually in the text it says the wife of Uriah, it doesn't even mention her name, is Bathsheba. Bathsheba, as you may know the story, King David is now at the height of his power. He should be out with his troops, but he's at home, resting in Jerusalem, enjoying the luxury of being king, and he spots Bathsheba. And he takes Bathsheba for himself, finds out that she's married to one of his soldiers. And so David continues to scheme and try to figure out a way. How could he get him to come back? And maybe they could, so then maybe when she's pregnant, it won't be weird. Eventually, nothing's working, so David sends him back to the front lines where he's killed. And then he takes Bathsheba as his wife. That child dies, but later, another child from Bathsheba is named Solomon, who continues the kingly line of David, eventually getting us to Jesus. Three Gentiles, three sexual encounters that were not on the up and up. And yet all four of them are part of the genealogy that leads to Jesus. Now, Matthew could have chosen other ladies to highlight. I mean, why not include Sarah? She's the matriarch of this whole thing. Or Rebecca, who's married to Isaac. Or Rachel, who's married to Jacob. No. He chooses these four women to remind the reader that Jesus came from the marginalized and the outside. These four stories, which no one would want to claim credit for, Matthew puts out front and center and says, this is where your king comes from. He is from people just like you. Most people would look at that genealogy and go, I don't think so. Matthew says, print it. Because this is how Jesus interacts with us. The other part of this that is interesting is that obviously the very next section we're going to see next week is the Christmas story, the birth of Jesus. And the scandal around Mary, an unwed young girl being pregnant, as we know, shockwaves throughout Israel. And yet, her story is like many of these other great women who in these really perilous times were faithful and gave rise to great children, all of whom helped redeem Israel and make it great. The mention of those four women and then Mary at the end, this just highlights that God's plan includes everyone. Gentiles, outcasts, unexpected figures, people who you and I would not want to claim in our genealogy. Oh, we don't talk about so-and-so. Matthew says, here it is, front and center. Okay, well, thank you for walking through that with me. Let's wrap it up this morning with thinking about how does this then connect to us? What are some implications from the king's genealogy? What can we take away from this that maybe we can walk through in these next few days? And first of all, I just think it's great to notice that Jesus' family tree describes where he came from, but it doesn't define who he is or who he will be. Your genealogy describes where you came from, but it does not have to define who you are or who you will be. Jesus' genealogy is filled with liars, adulterers, murderers, incest, polygamy, prostitution, idol worship, foreigners. Maybe your family tree has some similar things in it as well. Things that maybe you're not really proud of. Maybe people in your genealogy that have done incredible harm to you over the years. Or your family has that kind of name in some social circles because of the people who came before you. I think it's so great that Jesus came from these kinds of people, but he didn't follow that same path. It described where he came from, but it did not define who he is. And you and I can have that same outlook on life. Your family tree does not have to define you. Your past does not have to define you. There's this incredible freedom in Jesus that when you join his family and you're part of his family tree as followers, that all the things that came before you in your biological family that is difficult or depressing or drag you down do not have to be the thing that defines you now. As we were talking about this on Wednesday, and we came to this part in the teaching, and Pastor Ray said something that I thought was so profound. I wrote it down, and I wanted to share it with you. He mentioned that thinking about this, he says, you know, we don't look back to our past to blame. We look back for understanding. I'm not the way I am because of so-and-so. I want to understand where I came from, the good and the bad, so now I can move forward, and I can leave a legacy, which is far more important than thinking about where you came from. Jesus can free us from that negative family cycle in which we exist. Describes us, but doesn't define us. Here's the second thing. Jesus' family tree contained two types of people. The failures and faithfulness. Jesus' family tree contains failure, lots of failure, major scandals. Really, really, really nasty stuff. But also incredible faithfulness. Some of the people that are in that genealogy that you can go find their story in the Old Testament, but there's also quite a few toward the end that we know nothing about them. And yet somehow, some way, their faithfulness at key times kept the genealogy moving. And your family probably contains the same. There's probably failure, but there's also faithfulness. And even thinking for a moment about your spiritual family tree, someone at some point in time was faithful and shared the gospel with you. And I often like to think of that person who shared the gospel with me, who introduced me to Jesus. I wonder who introduced Jesus to them. And I wonder who introduced Jesus to them. And eventually you get your way all the way back to those 120 people in the upper room in Acts chapter 2 that started the whole thing. So your biological family tree, and if you're a follower of Jesus, your spiritual family tree, have lots of ups and downs, lots of good and bad. And yet God is working in all of that at all times. And even if your family tree contains some pretty, pretty horrible things that you don't want to think about, God still somehow worked in that and brought you to this point right here, right now. See, Matthew wants his readers to see that God has been using all types of people to move his plan forward. He's done the same in your life as well, and in my life. All kinds of people, all types of situations to get us to where we are right here, right now. Pretty incredible. And this really is the gospel message in many ways, the beginning of the gospel message. And I finish your notes with this statement right here. Think about Jesus and the where he came from and where he's about to go and what he's about to do, how we're going to be introduced to his ministry. And you think about it like this. Jesus entered the brokenness of the world and associated with broken people. People just like his ancestors. People just like us. So that the world might be saved through him. He truly is a king like no other. And if he is your king, then your allegiance to him should be first and foremost. It is his kingdom that we are a part of far better than any other earthly kingdom we may be connected to. And as your king, as we're going to see in this book, he presents to you a very upside-down kingdom. He's a king that doesn't come from fanfare. He comes from normalcy and weirdness, born in a manger as a baby. And his kingdom is just as upside down. We're going to see Jesus teach us things like, actually, it is the servant who is the greatest. You're to love everyone, including your enemies. I will give my life for you. I am the king, and I will give my life for you so that you can be part of my kingdom. He really is a king like no other. We're excited to go on this journey with you here in the next few months, years, however long it takes us. But we're excited. Let's close in prayer to our king. Thank you, Father. In Jesus' name, we come to you, praising you for who you are, for what you've done in our lives. I'm so grateful that we have a gospel account like Matthew's that gives us insight into who you are, Jesus, that draws us to you, and to know that you love us so much, that you came to this earth and from the beginning demonstrated what it's like to be in your kingdom, to be a follower of you. Thank you that you heal us from our hurts, you take our past and you make something good out of it. You give us hope for the future. We're grateful for how you've entered into our lives. And we're so grateful to call you King. And I thank you for this church. Thank you for the people that are here this morning, the people that are watching online, that we will continue to love you and serve you through our days, and that we will truly think of you as King. Love you, Jesus, and pray in your name. Amen.
Amen.
Hey, thanks for being here this morning. I'll be up front, and a few other leaders will as well if you want someone to pray with you or talk with you. Have a great rest of your week. We'll see you next time.